As great change is coming, one day you'll wake with wings. My cousin, as great change is coming, one day you'll wake with wings. Cousin Caterpillar, seven pairs of legs for you. Cousin Caterpillar, can you tell me what they do? Well, all that I can say is that they seem to help somewhere. Pull my little ball head off. Pull my little ball head off. Well, first of them all, they're used. But worry and you only lose. So I said, I love you, and I love what you do. Mom, do your thing.
And that was Cousin Caterpillar by a band called the Incredible String Band. One doesn't hear their name much anymore, and unless, of course, on programs like this, and in that case, no one's listening anyway. So I thought I'd play that tune because last show I spoke about the transformative evolution that Yiddish theater needs to go through, and I thought, well, what could be more fitting? From a caterpillar to a butterfly, or perhaps a moth, but in that case, a good-looking moth. This weekend, as a matter of fact, as I speak, Gullus Festival is ending. It started last Thursday on a farm in Goshen, New York, and it will continue for another couple of hours at a retreat in Stony Point, New York. Apparently there were some difficulties that forced them to move the last day of the festival, but I was there, and yesterday, and it was quite an interesting experience. I came up just at the point of the middle of the services, the middle of the Sabbath services, which kind of I expected them to have services of some kind, because it is something that was for Orthodox, non-Orthodox, an open forum. So I expected there would be services. However, I was a little... I didn't know how to react to the way they went about it. Because for all intents and purposes, it was an Orthodox service. The style of the service was Orthodox. However, the participation in the service was completely egalitarian. Women and men participated on a completely equal footing. That is to say, women were called up to read the Torah. Women were called up for aliyahs. As a matter of fact, three brothers went up at the same time for an aliyah, two sisters went up at the same time for an aliyah. So it had all the trappings of an Orthodox service. However, there was obviously there was mixed seating. And men and women participated on a completely equal footing. I found it strangely comforting and yet disconcerting. Comforting because it is the style of service that I grew up with. And had the participation of people who looked very much like the people that I knew going to synagogue when I was a kid. But it had a completely enlightened feel to it. Now, why should that make me uncomfortable? Because it's very unusual. And I just didn't quite know how to react. I sat there. I had an aliyah. It was an honor for me, and I appreciated it. But I sat there most of the time really kind of stunned. I don't know that I can take that any further, other than to say this is the kind of, I guess this is the kind of process, or this is the kind of mix that is one of the chief values of things like the Gullus Festival and Yiddish Fun. And that will be, but I wonder if indeed there is this vision comes to be of a working community, Yiddish-speaking community, that is a mixture of Orthodox and secularist Yiddish speakers and people of all shades of religious denomination within the Jewish religion, how that's going to play out, because I guess there'll be like four or five different services going on all the time. It will be interesting to see how that develops. However, in this particular instance, that is how it was handled. There were people who stayed away, not too many, and most people were there. And those that were there were free to either participate or read a book or sleep. It was outdoors under a tent, an awning, I guess. And after prayers, there were workshops. There was a group of people from a spiritual community in Stony Point, which is where the festival moved, that also has whose thing is, organic gardening and waging nonviolence and interdenominationalism. They have a permanent community made up of Muslims, Jews, and Christians, and they were very nice and very very interesting. It happened that they were all women that came, and somebody actually asked what happened to the men, which leave the men, and it happens that this summer their internship program, which they have every summer, was all women. They spoke about, there was even a woman who spoke about having been born Christian and then discovering that Judaism was more her thing and coming to Judaism. So it was a mixed bag and interesting. I think the thing that I am waiting for as far as Yiddish Farm is concerned is actually doing some planting. I was very disappointed that this summer there was no attempt even made to do any kind of planting. Of course, nobody lives there permanently right now. But I had suggested that they plant some herbs, peppermint, sage, basil, that will, under the right circumstances, pretty much take care of themselves. And at least say We planted that. That was our first effort at growing something in the ground. But these things have to develop in their own time, and hopefully next season there will be, and I know there are plans already, to actually start some agricultural activity next season up there, and I'm certainly looking forward to it. In terms of Yiddish theater, this is, of course, the kind of community that will also contribute to the lifespan, the continued life of Yiddish theater. It's the perfect community. It's the perfect kind of community for it. And I am not so much hoping, I'm not so much looking at it in terms of a place where, we can perform, although we will obviously perform and have workshops, rather as a place from which it will be possible to draw Yiddish actors and Yiddish performers down the road to participate in Yiddish theater for a wider audience. That is really the chief contribution if this place ever gets off the ground, to provide from its own ranks Yiddish actors, and also to welcome young actors from around the world who are working already working in Yiddish theater in Poland, in France, in Australia, in Romania, in Israel, and to offer them a place where they can live in a Yiddish-speaking environment, not only in the Yiddish-speaking environment, but in an environment that values Yiddish culture and Jewish identity, and is receptive to artistic creation. So, that's why I'm working, trying to work with these young folks as best I can and participating. And I hope that we can continue the good work. As far as other activities happening right now, I want to once again promote the Yiddish Theater Workshop, which happens every Thursday. This Thursday, it will once again be at 127 West 24th Street in Manhattan. We are reading Gutmensch in Taiwan, Jacob Gordon's Faust play, I guess. It's interesting when we talk about it, when we talked about it last week, some people lean towards the Eov play, the Job and his tribulations. Some people seem to look upon it as a Faust piece. I guess it's fair to use both. It is not like Job in the sense that he is the protagonist is tested not through tribulation but through good fortune. Big difference. And the devil basically bets with God that he can corrupt God's most faithful servant. And he does a bang-up job of doing so. Corrupt him with money. He also corrupts him with, sexual lust and sexual temptation. And eventually, of course, there's a horrible end awaits him. The devil seems to have a very good time, and in the end, one wonders why God made a bet that he knew he would lose. But, you know, there are a lot of questions we gotta have. We continually ask ourselves about God and why God does things and in his own inimitable way, or her own inimitable way, or but the play itself is quite good. Some people call it Gordon's best work. Other people call it one of his best works. It's available in translation in a book of translations by Namasandra, which I guess if you look her up, you'll find the actual title of the book. It's N-A-H-M-A, Sandrow, S-A-N-D-R-O-W. And if you care to download it from the National Yiddish Book Center, it's available. You can search Jacob Gordon, G-O-R-D-I-N, and you will be able to download not only that, but pretty much all of his works. Gordon wrote maybe 70 or 80 plays. He wrote some that he didn't put his name on because he was too proud to put his name on boiler pot work that he did just for money. He had a large family, and he often needed to raise money, and he did so by writing a plays to order, which he didn't care to put his real name on. His best-known works, I guess, would be the Yiddish King Lear and Mirla Ephras. I believe that Mirla Ephras was the most produced Yiddish play in the repertoire of great Yiddish plays. He had a couple of plays produced on Broadway. One was an English translation of the Kreutzer Sonata. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. It's Kreutzer Sonata in Yiddish. And that's a play about also a play about a family whose family life becomes very complicated and through various pandering and philandering. It was produced on Broadway in English. Ida Kaminska produced a couple of his things on Broadway in Yiddish, including Mirla Ephras. She herself was her singer. So he's quite a well-known a playwright, and was credited with lifting Yiddish theater from the silly kind of vaudeville or light operetta style to a more serious world theater. You know, he was a contemporary of Ibsen and Gorky and Hauptmann and others, and he is like if Goldfaden is the father of Yiddish theater, then Gordon is the stern uncle who raised it up to be a mensch. And we're reading this particular work. I'm more or less at a loss as to what to read next of all the things that we've prepared, that I have prepared. But we'll get through this one first, and we will see what comes after. There are so many. The chief problem is that there are so many great plays. It just seems virtually inexhaustible. The material that's available. However, I have decided, and by the way, if anybody who isn't listening wants to call in and have a have a word with me, chastise me, educate me in general, just say something. I'm going to try and find the telephone number now. I thought I had it, but it eludes me at the moment. Anyway, I'll find it. So I've decided to actually try, perhaps, to read things in English, just because. Oh, here it is. 888-815-9756. 888-815-9756. Just because it will give more people an opportunity to participate. And it will also begin to suggest to folks that they need not think of Yiddish theater solely as something in Yiddish. Now, again, this goes back to something I was talking about 2 weeks ago. And I haven't figured it out yet. But I keep thinking about it, and presumably some are others. And that is the struggle for a redefinition of Yiddish culture and its place in Jewish identity. I still cannot shake the idea that Yiddish culture is basically the foundation of, is the foundation of European Jewish culture, Ashkenazic Jewry's tradition and foundation. It's hard for me at this point to make a distinction between the two, although people are passionate about saying, no, that's not Yiddish. That's not, how can you? You know, people are and I can't make sense of it. I nobody has yet explained their position to me in a way that I can say, okay, that makes sense. I mean, they are, first of all, I think that this, the Israel and Hebrew have kind of dimmed the, it's been, it's muddied the waters somewhat, and it's, of course, because its position ideologically was that Yiddish, there was no Yiddish culture. I mean, there was Yiddish, but you couldn't call it culture. They basically looked upon it as something to be denigrated, something to be ashamed of, something that has had only negative connotations. It has muddied the water considerably, to the extent that it may never be a way to clear the haze. But it seems to me, at any rate, that any Ashkenazic Jew going back 1, 2, 3 generations, in some cases, maybe a few more, will find Yiddish as a part of the culture, the culture dish that he comes from. And of course, again, I'm sure there are going to be people who deny it, especially some yekkes out there who say, "Oh no, we always scratch a little bit deeper beneath the surface, and you'll find Yiddish down there somewhere." Now, I don't know how that is deniable. I don't know how that people can talk. And remember, I'm talking now about Ashkenazic Jews. I'm not talking about the Sephardic community. That's a separate issue, and I'm not dealing with it. I don't include that in this conversation. But I, again, I have to maintain that, you know, it's as many Hebrew schools and Hebrew camps and Israel programs in Israel and learn Hebrew as much as that exists today, that is something that belongs to modern Jewish history. And again, I think is doesn't in no way do anything to convince me otherwise about Yiddish being the core of Ashkenazic Jewish culture. So, having you know, if we start from that place, we also have to admit that these days Yiddish, and again, there are people who want to talk about the Renaissance of Yiddish, and Yiddish is shrinking away. It's still with us, thank God. It's still it's. I was going to say it's still evolving. And actually, it's kind of we've got to make sure that's the goal, really, is to make sure that it does keep evolving, that it doesn't stagnate, and despite the fact that there is a good deal of inertia, I think it can still be, that inertia can still be dislodged, we will have to find a way to change our way of thinking about and again, not just Yiddish, but Jewish identity, and realize that has everything to do with Yiddish, at least acknowledge that is where the roots of it are. And again, Ashkenazic Jewish identity. But fewer and fewer people can really relate to it. If you're going to say that it has, you know, it's Yiddish identity has to be wrapped up totally in the language of Yiddish, that if you're going to do things in English or other languages, that it's not, well, then you're going to lose the game altogether. And I can't, really can't bring myself to feel otherwise about it. There just aren't enough people outside of the Hasidic community that speak Yiddish, that will come to a Yiddish play and understand what's going on without super titles, without a simultaneous translation. There are less and less people who have any interest in coming to see a Yiddish play because they've stopped thinking of it as part of their history, of their heritage. And that's the battle that we need to fight. If we need to entice people by other means, or if we have to change the way that we think of Yiddish theater so that it includes great Jewish theater in other languages, then we need to do that. We need to find a way to integrate that. That's going to be an uphill struggle, I think, it is possible to do. You know, Yinglish has really become the middle ground, compromise, plays that are partly in English, partly in Yiddish, and there's nothing wrong with that, and I think there would be nothing at all wrong including plays that were originally written in French, originally written in Hebrew, or originally written in Russian, and performing them as part of a Yiddish theater repertoire. You know, there'll always be opposition to that. Well, I shouldn't say always, but I can understand that there would be strong opposition to that. And we just have to keep floating these ideas and trying to discuss it. Talking about it is really the key. Just keeping the conversation going, keeping the discussion going. So, in terms of things coming up in the world of Yiddish, there are, of course, the usual things. And as far as particular performances here in New York, there's really nothing on the horizon right now. Of course, we do our Yiddish Theater Workshop every Thursday at 8 o'clock. We've suspended our acting classes till after Labor Day. But after Labor Day, we'll start them up again. We're going to have some very exciting guest teachers, Moshe Yasur, Rafael Goldwasser, and others will be giving workshops and classes. And, of course, we'll continue to read Yiddish plays. And as I said, I am seriously considering introducing some plays in English translated from the French, translated from Russian and from Hebrew. And I think that'll be fun and perhaps give more people a chance to participate. But right now, in terms of performance, it's kind of quiet in town. The first week of August will be the beginning of the Yiddish Farm Retreat in Maryland, and Class Canada will be happening in August. Of course, Yiddish Vach, the last week in August, an initiative of Jugendtruth, in which people get together and speak entirely in Yiddish. And I'm saying this to you, not you know, I'm just throwing my own two cents in. Yiddish Vach is something that, even if you don't really speak Yiddish, is kind of worth looking into. I mean, even if you only have the most rudimentary ability, I think it's worthwhile. And you do your best. You go and you do your best. You speak as well as you can. I don't think anybody will chase you out of there for not speaking a wonderfully fluent Yiddish. And if they do, just give me the name. Take the name and give it to me. you can find out about it through jugendtruf.org, jugendtruf.org, see what you think. It, you never know. It might be a wonderful experience for you if you care about Yiddish and have often said to yourself, gee, I wish I knew more Yiddish. Let's see, other news in the music world. J-Dub Records is folding. J-Dub Records had, my favorite band on their label is Golem. And they had a great number of other progressive, alternative, Yiddish, klezmer, world music bands. Apparently, if you go to their website, there's an explanation for it, a long explanation for it. having to do with business models and the changing economy and the changing music business and so on and so forth. It's a pity to see them go. The world of klezmer and world music and Jewish music is fairly active. It's not like we've lost the last vestige of them. But it is a pity. And who knows? They may transform themselves into something else. I know the Weimar Festival is in full swing in Weimar, Germany. Workshops of all kinds having to do with music. Workshop, I don't know what they call it over there in Warsaw, but there is an event going on in Warsaw, there's one going on in Vilnius right now, there'll be one coming up in Brussels. Again, as I said 2 weeks ago, there are a lot of these events, at some point, I know they are valuable simply for the fact that people meet each other and network and connections are made. It would be nice if, apart from the personal connections that people make, some permanent, productive institution having to do with the transformation of Yiddish culture and Jewish identity evolved from all these things. And I repeat this over and over and over again. And it's a luxury that one can afford when nobody listens. Who cares? I can just sit here and repeat myself for the next 20 minutes, and it really wouldn't matter much. And I may sound a bit dispassionate today about the things I'm talking about, but one can't maintain a high level of enthusiasm all the time. I am convinced that that kind of a result is necessary for all of these festivals and workshops to have any kind of lasting value. Perhaps we are getting closer to it as more young people start to participate in these things and new blood comes in. New ways of thinking are going to also creep in, and I'm hopeful that at some point some concrete results will come of it, of all these activities that are going on around the world. So I want to talk a little bit about Cholent and Yitzhak Schoenfeld. Now, Yitzhak is a man who understands that once one steps into the circle of conformity, you just plain lose a bit of your edge. Why do I say that? Cholent it's like a primordial soup of consisting of the most diverse elements in Jewish culture, including Sephardic Jewish culture, and these elements through Cholent are constantly redefining and evolving, redefining themselves and evolving. It is possibly the most important activity I know of in the evolution of Jewish identity and Jewish culture. bar none. And Yitzhak is doing it entirely on his own, just about virtually no formal support. He doesn't write grants. He's not a nonprofit corporation. Occasionally, somebody might kick in a few bucks as simply on the odd moment. Nothing, not through any active solicitation on Yitzhak's part. And I keep saying to Yitzhak, why don't you? And, you know, his answer has become obvious to me. And that is that the minute you include yourself in any kind of formal institutional structure, you're stepping into that circle of conformity. And it no longer has, because when you write a grant, you are required to fulfill the obligation you assume by taking the money, because you're given the money for a particular reason. You write a grant to do this, you write a grant to do that. If you have a board of directors and you have people who are donating money, they expect a certain amount of control over what it is, how their money is spent, and what you're doing. After all, that's why you have a board of directors. And this is anathema to the freedom to do whatever, to let people do whatever it is they want to do. Now, I am the first to say that at times it gets out of hand with children. Because people can, you know, up to a point, it's okay, but sometimes people take things a little too far and they begin to do things that are simply, how shall we say, sociopathic. It has its downside as well. But Yitzhak is just the most nonconformist person I know. Despite the fact, and here is the irony of it, he is completely orthodox in his personal life. He has accepted all the restrictions inherent in being an Orthodox Jew, what you can eat, what you can't eat, when you can have sex, how you have sex, what blessing you say after you go to the bathroom, before you eat, after you eat, how you get up in the morning, how you go to sleep. There isn't an aspect of life that is not regulated in some way. And here is a person who, in his private life, is able to accept that, and yet in his role as the originator, founder, and sustainer of Cholent, and Cholent, for those of you who don't know, happens every Thursday night in New York. It moves from place to place. And I'll tell you, part of the reason it moves from place to place is that eventually, in most situations where it was housed in an institution, eventually that institution asked them to leave. And it is because there is an element of it that is... it's not beyond control. I don't want people to get the idea that there are riots and it's not a rave. However, it can get very rowdy. It can get very, you get a crowd of people outside on the street smoking cigarettes. By the end of the night, the sidewalk is 6 inches high in cigarette butts, and, people are... discussing, arguing, challenging each other in friendly but heated discussion. Sometimes there's a little too much noise, one thing or another, but it is difficult to find a permanent home by relying on other people's facilities. simply because of that fact. So Chillant is itinerant. There's always a lecture. It always begins, well, these days we are beginning with the Yiddish Theater Workshop reading. And look, for me, it was a natural partnership. First of all, because Yitzhak's a friend of many years and someone who I have tremendous respect for. And secondly, because there are a lot of Yiddish speakers that come to Chillant. There are a lot of the people whose concern is Jewish identity, either running away from it or coming back to it or discovering it or somehow trying to redefine it. I think you'll find all those things at Chillant. And therefore, it seems a natural place to engage in a theater workshop, because the event itself is extremely theatrical. and as I say, it's a natural place to find people who might be interested in having a long-term commitment to Yiddish theater. So I just wanted to say a few words about it and encourage people, if you're in the New York City area. There's no real place for me to tell you come and you know look up this website or that website. And if you're interested in the in Chillant, send an email to info@newyiddishrep.org, just stating your interest, and I'll make sure that you get on the mailing list for the event, and you'll be informed every week where it will be. It usually starts very late. The acting classes start at 7, and the reading starts at 8, but the lectures start 9:30, 10 o'clock, 10:30, and Chillant is an all-night activity. It goes on till the wee hours of the morning. As long as anybody has the strength to schmooze, talk, discuss, sing, Yitzhak is there, and it rolls on. So those are a few words about Chillant. I mention it because of this Romeo and Juliet film that has hit the movie theater. One movie theater is Lincoln Plaza Cinemas, or one of the complexes that has Lincoln Center involved. And it did very well, and that movie came out of Chillant. I mean, it was born out of that mix. It crawled out of that soup, clawed its way into existence, and here it is. Whatever you may think of it, it's a marvel that the thing actually was created, and Eve Annenberg managed to create it, and that it has had such a great deal of exposure and been a topic of discussion and been received, all in all, received extremely favorably. It's interesting. I was going to see the Shalom Aleichem documentary, and a woman said to me, did you see the Romeo and Juliet riding down the escalator? And I said, no, not yet. She said, I saw it. I didn't like it. I said, well, what about it? Didn't you like it? She said, it was disrespectful. It was irreverent. I didn't like the... Now, I haven't seen the movie, so I can't comment on this. I didn't like the juxtaposition of the Kol Nidre service with the sex scene. There's a bit of nudity in it. Nothing to compare with what you can see on television today. But it is remarkable that a Yiddish film about the Hasidic Romeo and Juliet would contain it at all. So people talk about it. But this woman was not Orthodox by any stretch of the imagination. She was not fanatically Orthodox. She seemed like a very middle class a second generation or third generation American who belongs to your local conservative or reform synagogue, or not somebody who you would think would react this way. But it's funny the kinds of feelings that anything that has to do with the Hasidic community, when viewed in any light other than what people, you know, the stereotype that people have in their minds about it, if you formulate that in any other way, it becomes to people react in a very funny way, and they can be very, say, why would they react that way? What is it? But they do, and this woman obviously, you know, I'm sure that there are a lot of people who have very little to do with the world of the Hasidim or the Hasidic community. When they see something like this, they get turned off. Well, how can they, as though the Hasidim are, you know, they represent somehow the spiritual the spiritual country of Jewish identity, of Judaism. And anytime you see them viewed in a different light, I guess people become uncomfortable. And much the same way that I was somewhat uncomfortable at the services at the Golos Festival. So I guess I can be as guilty of that as anybody else. My feelings are also tied into my general inability to feel comfortable, totally comfortable with religion, with religious institutions. And it's interesting, we read at the theater workshop, we just finished reading Uriel Acosta, which is about someone who discovered after a Murano who grew up as a Catholic, who discovers that his roots are Jewish two or three generations back, becomes fascinated, and whose only frame of reference is the Old Testament. The crux of the story is that when Acosta decided to leave Portugal and go to Amsterdam and practice Judaism openly, he encountered rabbinic Judaism for the first time. And realized that what he viewed as the simple Old Testament religion, you know, that old time religion that was simple, that was direct, that spoke to him so hauntingly, that there was an aspect of it totally controlled by human prerogatives, the rabbinic aspect of the religion, in which people are trying to figure out, what does this mean? What did God mean by this? So the concept of putting a fence around the Torah, which, you know, the Torah has 613 mitzvot of omission and commission, and those 613 become a myriad of rules and restrictions and rabbinic mandates and customs and so on and so forth. And Acosta, when he realized that, said, wait a minute, what is this? This is not. And when he began to speak about it, he realized that in some ways the religious freedom he sought by openly practicing Judaism in those times could be just as stifling as the horrors of the Inquisition, although the type of torture inflicted was psychological rather than physical, and he himself suffered excommunication, which resulted in a horrible isolation, and it eventually led to his suicide. So, you know, there's, as they say, there's more than one way to skin a cat if you want to go that route. But anyway, yes, there are a lot of things to consider, and there are a lot of things that I find disconcerting about religion of any kind. You know, these feelings are always there, but it's interesting how the Hasidim are more or less earmarked for special reactions. I guess what I could suggest to you is take a day to go Friday night or Saturday. Take yourself down to Borough Park. Williamsburg is a tough call. You know, I don't suggest you go to Williamsburg. It's a little less welcoming. But go to Williamsburg. Go to Borough Park and walk the streets. Pick a little shul out. Go inside. Chances are nobody will boot you out. And if you want to observe firsthand, take the trip. Make the trip. You will find it interesting, and I think that it will, to some extent, change your attitude, having come in direct contact. We're almost done. It's hard for me to believe that I managed to prattle on here for an hour. I'd like to take you out with something perhaps a bit more coherent than what I've been talking about, and I lost it. I wanted to play the rest of Caterpillar for you, but I lost it. Let me see if I can bring it back. Here we go. So have a great couple of weeks, we'll see you in a couple of weeks. And prattle on some more. Thanks for not listening. And here's a little treat for you, the Incredible String Band. From way back when. There's a little sing-along in here, so, you know, I'll jump in. Please feel free to me. Great changes coming, one day you'll wake Da-do-da, da-do-da, da-do-da. Da-do-da, da-do-da, da-do-da. Somehow I always loved that one. Cousin Caterpillar, seven pairs of legs for you. Cousin Caterpillar, can you tell me what they do? Well, all that I can say is that they seem to help somewhere. Pull my little ball along. Pull my little ball along. Well, broken up, they're you. But worry and you're only lose. So I said, I love you, and I love you too. Come on, do your thing. Thanks.